My name is Subramanian Ramaswamy, and I'm a product manager in the Service Fabric team. And since my name is such that only my mother can get it right, I go by a slightly shorter name, Mani, two syllables. And since there are two operating systems on the title, we figured we'll have two speakers here.
So that's why I'm here. I'm Sean McKenna. I'm a product manager on the Azure Compute team, working on Service Fabric, among other things. And before we dive in, we thought we'd do a little bit of level setting on kind of the goals of the talk, particularly in the context of some of the other talks that we're doing on Service Fabric this week at Ignite. This is going to be very much an entry-level, developer-focused session on Azure Service Fabric. So I think there's potentially a couple reasons why people would be in the room. One is you're a developer who's brand new to Service Fabric and you're interested in learning more about it and how you can get started building applications. I'm curious how many people fall into that camp. Okay, a good number of you. The second reason might be that you're familiar with Service Fabric, but now you're interested in learning about how it's going to work on Linux. How many people are in that group? Okay, slightly smaller. Okay, great. So, like I say, developer-focused session. So if you're interested in some of the operational aspects, some of the management aspects, we would definitely recommend the bottom session there Friday morning. And then if you're interested in a slightly deeper dive and a little bit more around best practices and guidance for building applications, so another developer-focused session, the top one, which is tomorrow afternoon. And then there's a middle session that happened earlier today. It was a little bit more around general value proposition, which you can watch on demand. So with that, let's cover just kind of the general agenda. We're going to go into microservices in general as an application pattern and some of the value and the benefits that you can derive from that. Then dive into some of the constructs that you need to understand as developers getting started on Service Fabric, so some of the things you need to understand. And then we'll dive into those two operating systems that Manny mentioned. So we'll talk about Service Fabric on Windows, run through kind of a 101 demo of what that developer experience looks like, and then look at very much the same thing on the Linux side. So with that, Manny, would you like to kick us off talking a little bit about microservices?
Absolutely. Thanks, John. So before we define what a microservice is and what they do, let's first kind of motivate the problem. So what is the problem with monolithic applications today? So the problem with monolithic applications is that they have tightly coupled components. All the components are intermingled tightly. So the problem is if you have to update something, you have to update a lot of things. And it's kind of a positive feedback loop because now, hey, you know, I will tell Sean, hey, I need to update this part of my, my service, this component, and Sean's going to say, fine, you know, I'll make my update, but I have five updates that I would like to do, so why don't you actually make your updates for those five updates? So all these updates kind of get bigger and bigger. It kind of snowballs into something more massive, and the resultant thing is, well, it's not very agile, is it? I just wanted a small fix, but now I have to wait for every component to actually make their updates. It's going to take longer, and whenever it takes longer, it means, well, time to market is critical. I'm losing money. The second problem with monolithic applications is, and when I get the clicker working, you scale these by scaling the entire app. There is no concept of actually just scaling one component five times and the other component two times. You have to, if you want like a scale of five for a particular component, you scale the entire application five times, which means it's now expensive because if I cared was three instances of the kind of pale pink microservice component, I have to actually still scale all the blue components as well. So that's waste money. So these are the kind of problems that monolithic applications have. So microservices, how do they kind of help with this problem? They do one thing and they do it well. So the first thing is all these microservices are basically independent. They are independent units of compute and state. So if I do something, it is not really affecting someone else. If I do something to my microservice, Sean's microservice shouldn't be affected.
Better not be.
And as a result, what happens is normally developed by a smaller team, by a smaller cross-functional team. It's not like, a 50-member team generally that we see. What we see is generally it's a few developers, a pizza team, two pizza team maybe, who are developing these microservices. And finally, because now it's kind of decentralized. There is no, you know, central governance for this, as in, hey, you got to use all these frameworks and everything. You have to interact with me, so I need you to write in the same language, use the same framework that I'm using. You can use whatever is appropriate for the microservice that you're building. You know, whatever language, whatever framework, you can just use that. The second thing with microservices is that they are loosely coupled. Now, what does this mean? Well, it means that everything that a monolithic application is, when I say it's tightly coupled, it's not true here. You communicate with other microservices through well-defined protocols. There is no hidden API that I'm using. Oh, I know you're running in process, and I know you're in memory location 0xFF, so I will just do some magic there to get you. No, I talk to you through well-defined protocols. I use HTTP, for example, to communicate to another microservice. So the immediate requirement there is, well, all microservices should have unique names which can be resolved. I should be able to talk to Sean's microservice. I should be able to talk to someone else's microservice. I shouldn't need any magic in order to do that. Now, the advantage that comes with this loosely coupled architecture is now I can independently scale microservices. I can have 8 instances of my blue microservice and only have 7 instances of my pink microservice. It doesn't matter. I can scale independently. Same thing when it comes to update. I can independently update. If I update my blue microservice, it doesn't affect everyone else. It doesn't have to, I don't have to necessarily take everyone else along with my update and tell them, hey, you need to update this too. Let's take some downtime. Let's actually take this whole shebang, push an update outside. No, we don't need to do that. We can independently update these microservices. Just to show you kind of a little more glimpse on what's the difference between monolithic and microservice applications, well, on the left-hand side, you have a monolithic application. So it's composed of components that are tightly coupled. The way you typically achieve scale, as I mentioned, is, well, you scale the entire application, and you scale by cloning the application across multiple machines. If you need a scale instance of 3, well, you stamp it on 3 machines. If you need 10, you stamp it on 10 machines. And so all the components come along for the ride, whether you need it or not. In the case of the microservices application, well, you know, you can have multiple applications sharing the same set of nodes, and you can scale each instance however many times that is appropriate. You know, 5 instances of yellow or green and 2 instances of red, it's all appropriate because it doesn't matter. And what this allows you to do is, well, I can have higher density. With a fewer number of VMs, I can run a large number of microservices, and I can even run multiple applications on the same VM. If you come from a cloud services background, on the left-hand side is what happens. If you look at a worker role, you have one application that runs on a VM, whereas in the microservice world, you can have multiple applications that share the same group of VMs. The second thing which I also talked about is the idea that state is now independent. So in the case of monolithic applications, again, you know, you had a single tier, you had multiple tiers, but every tier used to share the same frameworks, used to share everything, and they were all backed by a gigantic storage unit, which basically took care of all your state needs. In the microservices case, however, now there is nothing like this. It's all interconnected services. You might have some stateless front end. You might have some stateless back-end microservices which are talking to external stores. Sean is going to talk to you later about a concept called stateful microservices that Service Fabric introduces, where compute and data are co-located. You can have a mix and match of all this. It doesn't matter. Each microservice is responsible for its own data and compute. So this is all goodness. You know? So, you know, microservices increase agility through, you know, making good components that can talk to each other through well-defined interfaces, simplifies upgrades, more agile. You get better productivity because your microservice is task-appropriate, is written in task-appropriate languages with using the task-appropriate frameworks. You get better efficiency and better hardware utilization because now these all can share the same VMs, and you can scale each of them independently. And again, you limit failures through isolation because if one microservice goes down, it doesn't mean that, you know, all the other microservices keel over also. Now, having said this, there are some caveats. You know, there are cases where a monolithic application is absolutely the right choice. You know, if you have a simple service that doesn't need to have all these scale demands, or, you know, it's just having a simple single database in the backend, it's a fine choice. But, you know, when you're looking at scale and when you're looking at larger applications, microservices may be the right solution because it gives you all of these benefits. But, and there's always a but, right? There's a catch. This is the world, you know, where which microservices enables. It enables you to do all these things. It doesn't mean that you get to go home early and say, hey, my problems are all solved. You still have to do all these things. It enables you to do all these things. But hey, you know what? You still have to write code for, hey, I need service discovery. You know, if Sean's service is running in node 1, I need to be able to talk to node 1. Well, if that node 1 went for a reboot and Sean's service moved over to node 4, I still need to find node 4. I need to write code in order to make that happen. State management. It's a wonderful world when each microservice is managing its own state. But guess what? Now I have to manage my own state. I have to write code for that. Lifecycle management. Gone are the days when you had a dedicated IT team that you could say, hey, you know, all of us are rolling together one gigantic update, so you take care of managing this upgrade, make sure everything is working. No, you are agile, which means I might be updating every single day, which also means that I am now responsible for rolling out these updates and rolling them back if something goes wrong. Health reporting. You know, if something goes wrong, nobody, you know, it's up to me, the microservice developer, to make sure, hey, I'm reporting health, my microservices are healthy, there are enough number of instances of the microservice that are running so that I can meet demand. All of these are now my problems. Dissociate, similar thing. I have machines. Now, do I need to add more machines? Am I using my capacity? Am I over-provisioned, under-provisioned? So all of these problems now fall to me as a microservice developer. Now, I got to wonder, you know, wouldn't it be awesome if there was a platform that actually took care of some of these things for us?
Manny, you're not going to believe this. We have an hour left in the session, and I have just the thing for you. Boom! All right, so as it turns out, we actually do have a microservices platform, and that's where we're going to spend the rest of the talk going through. So we take these microservices concepts that Manny talked about and layer them on top of a highly resilient, available platform that we call Service Fabric. And so there's a whole bunch of value propositions listed inside of that box there. So a bunch of those things that Manny talked about in terms of what you need to deal with as a developer come built in with Service Fabric. And what's more, it's available in multiple environments. So on Monday, we announced we've been GA for Windows in Azure since the Build conference back in March, I guess it was. And on this past Monday, we announced that we were now GA for our standalone installer on Windows Server. So you can take Service Fabric, set it up on your own private data center or in another public cloud, and you get exactly all the same benefits that are listed there in the middle block. And what's more, your developer experience is actually exactly the same. Which brings me to what does it look like to be a Service Fabric developer? So what I'm going to do is walk you through a few of the core constructs that you need to understand just to kind of get up and running in Visual Studio. The concepts that are going to hit you square in the face immediately as you start to build Service Fabric applications, just so that you understand those basics. There's a whole bunch more under the hood, and that's where I'd recommend going to the talk tomorrow from Jeffrey and Voss, if you're interested. But we're going to just get you started on the basics. So the first thing you need to understand is the notion of a Service Fabric cluster, which is basically just a set of machines that are stitched together. They can be either physical or virtual machines, stitched together to form a generalized pool of resources with a management abstraction on top of that you use to deploy applications and manage applications and scale them and so on. That can scale anywhere from 3 machines up to over 1,000 machines, which is what we have some of our internal customers using. And they're laid out such that they limit the impact of hardware failures or even software failures as upgrades are rolling out. So as you build applications and deploy them and upgrade them, the machines are set up such that if some of those machines go down, your application will always stay available. Okay, so that's kind of like the infrastructure side. On the application model side, there's a couple of key concepts to understand. The first is service types. So Manny talks kind of in general about microservices. This is where the rubber hits the road from the Service Fabric perspective. The service type you can think of as mapping to that microservice concept. And they're made up of, in case the service level, microservice level is not granular enough, you can go down and have multiple code, configuration, and data packages, each of which can be independently versioned and upgraded. Okay, so that's great. So you build out a bunch of microservices, but ultimately, usually what you're doing is you're putting those microservices together to try to solve some sort of business problem, right? Deliver some sort of customer scenario. So ultimately, whether it's represented systematically or not, you've got some set of services that are coming together to deliver that scenario. In the service fabric world, that sort of umbrella term is an application type. So an application type is made up of a number of service types, and that becomes your unit of deployment and upgrade, and each of those application types is versioned. So those are kind of the core concepts, applications and service types. So let's drill into the service level of it. So in terms of the types of services that you can build, the first is what we call guest executables, or now we support guest containers as well. And you can think of this as being any arbitrary piece of code, any arbitrary executable or container that you want to have as part of a Service Fabric application. You want to have the Service Fabric runtime deploy and manage for you. So this doesn't have to be something where you've actually locked into the Service Fabric API. You've got some existing application, some C++ application that you wrote 10 years ago, you can incorporate into a Service Fabric application and make sure that that's highly available and scalable as well. Then there's a couple of first-class concepts that we support, which are stateless services, so services where your state is actually managed separately. Now, you've still got the general microservice notion of that service being responsible for managing state from the perspective of any clients of that service. But from a Service Fabric perspective, that state is held somewhere else. Then one of the differentiating aspects of Service Fabric is what we call stateful services, which Manny alluded to, where you can have your state actually co-located with your compute. And the way that works is we've got a couple of different frameworks that I'm going to talk about in a second, where you can store that state using APIs that we provide, and that state then gets replicated out across those machines in the Service Fabric cluster so that that state is always available even if some of those machines happen to go down. There's multiple copies of it without necessarily having to have an external store. Those stateless and stateful services themselves can also be run inside containers. So you can either bring your own container and have that deployed, or you can take a stateless or stateful service, package it in a container, and deploy that as well. So in terms of the specific frameworks, breaks down into two groups. Reliable services, which for anybody that's done cloud services in the past, the basics of this API will look fairly familiar. It's general sort of lifecycle management of a service, so starting and stopping. And then in addition to that, on the stateful side, we have a set of collection APIs that you can use to store either key value pairs or queue type data, and again, have that replicated out across the cluster. We also support an actor model, which is suitable for cases where you've got very small independent units of state and compute that you want to have distributed widely across the cluster. And those things communicate through a prescriptive async messaging model and have their state automatically managed by virtue of writing it to the actor APIs. And again, Jeff and Voss will talk a little bit more about some of those options tomorrow. All right, enough slides. Let's see some stuff in action. Okay, so here we are in Visual Studio. We're going to start. I'm going to walk through just kind of building out a very simple application to kind of give you a sense of what the Visual Studio experience looks like. So once you install the Service Fabric SDK, under the Cloud node, you get this Service Fabric application template. So I'm going to create an app here. Oh, that's what happens when you practice your demo. The choice I'm going to get is what is the type of the first type of service that I want to create. So obviously, I'm going to be able to create many, many services over the lifetime of this application, but I have to choose one to start with. So I'll create a stateful service first. And with that, Visual Studio is going to go ahead and create a solution that has two projects in it. Oh, look at that handsome fella right there. Has two projects in it. One is the application project, which doesn't actually contain any code. It's actually just an umbrella for all the other service projects and includes a set of deployment artifacts that we can see over here. And then there's the stateful service itself, which is just a CSproj with the reliable service APIs already implemented. So let's take a very quick look at what this template code is doing. Again, without going into too much detail on how the stateful piece works, because we're just trying to get started here. But here's a reliable dictionary, which is one of those collection types that I talked about. So the template code is basically getting a reference to one of those dictionaries. It's called my dictionary, then running in a loop and incrementing a counter and storing it back inside the dictionary, storing it safely and reliably by virtue of that key value pair being written out across a number of machines. So the key that we're looking for is counter. We are incrementing it on every run of the loop and then committing it. So all of the stateful operations in Service Fabric are all transaction commit based. And so you once you get an ACK back from that commit API, you can be sure that it's been properly stored with strong consistency. The only other thing I'll point out here is this service event source. So this is writing an ETW event for every time through the loop and writing out the value of that counter. This is the way that we recommend that you do your logging. There's a nice UI in Visual Studio that I'll show for when you're doing local debugging, and it also works out well down the line in production when you want to hook that up to, say, Windows Azure Diagnostics to plumb it into OMS or into Elk or whatever tool works best for you. So with that, let's try debugging this. And while that gets started, I will switch over to look at our management plane. So this is called Service Fabric Explorer. This is a web-based dashboard that's served directly by the cluster. So in any environment that you can deploy a Service Fabric cluster, you can get this UI for doing management of your cluster as well as applications. So as that deploys, we start to see these concepts that I talked a little bit about showing up. So under applications, I've got the top-level application type. Then here's an application instance. And then underneath that, I can see that stateful service and that stateful service type. And again, all of these things are versioned, which helps you when you're doing upgrades. So switching back over to Visual Studio, if we switch into the diagnostic event viewer. So there's those ETW events that were being written out. You're seeing the counter increment. Whoa. A little too close for comfort. You see the counter increment as it runs through that loop. Okay, so kind of interesting, but there's much more to be done. I'm going to be doing a few different deployments. So one of the things I'm going to point out is, and actually you could see in Service Fabric Explorer, if I go up to the top level of the dashboard, there's 5 nodes here. This is running locally. It's the real runtime. It just so happens that there's 5 copies. So whereas in a 5-machine cluster, you would have 1 copy per machine, these are all crunched down onto this, this single development environment, which is great. It's high fidelity to what you'd see in a multi-machine environment, but it does add a little bit to your deployment time. So if you're doing really fast F5 deployments, what I would recommend is to switch over to what we call one node cluster mode, which basically allows you to test your business logic really quickly, but obviously takes away the possibility of doing any kind of failover because you've only got one node. So take that node down, it's all over. So you'll see some errors here as the Service Fabric Explorer fails to connect to the cluster because it's switching over. So while that's happening, I'll continue on and add another service. So what I'm going to do now is add a web front end to that stateful service. I'm going to have that web front end talk to the counter or to the stateful service and get the counter and display it in the web UI. So if I go back in here and add a service, like I say, you can add multiple services. So now this time I'm going to choose ASP.NET Core. And it's switched over to one node. And you get the standard options for ASP.NET. So I'll add a web application. And that's going to go ahead and add a second service. Now we've got two services. I could go ahead and deploy this. I would get the web application deployed. I would get the stateful service deployed. You know, those two things would be available and running. Where it gets interesting, of course, is now I want to stitch them together. So I want to have them be able to talk to each other. And this is where you start to have some options in terms of how you build your application. So when it comes to services talking to each other, there's two parts to it. The first one is around discovery. So how does the web application in this case, you can think of it as acting like the client, how does it discover where that stateful service is, right? Because Service Fabric is just taking that stateful service and deploying it on a machine that it thinks has resources available. Now the web application needs to be able to figure out where that thing is. So that's the first part. And then the second part is, how do the services actually talk to each other? How do they initiate the communication? What is the protocol they're using? What's the transport they're using? And so the first part of that, Service Fabric's very prescriptive. There is a naming service that is built in to the product where individual services get registered with that naming service. Services will want to talk to those services, query the naming service to resolve that endpoint and be able to talk to it. So that's one of the values of the microservices platform that Manny alluded to. The second part is very much up to you. Service Fabric provides a fully pluggable communication model where the developer of the service gets to decide, what is the endpoint that I want to expose here? Do I want to expose a REST API or HTTP, a TCP socket, a web socket, or even WCF? That's completely up to you. Now, that being said, Service Fabric provides some built-in options in terms of communication listeners. One of those is what we call the Service Fabric remoting infrastructure. And so that's what I'm going to use for tying together this web application with the stateful application. Now, that's based off of having a shared interface and client proxies, so very similar to other remoting solutions you may have used in the past. That involves a little bit of setup from a Visual Studio perspective, and Manny tells me that's not a very interesting demo, so I'm just going to kind of fast forward to one that's already got that set up and just kind of walk through what the pieces are. So the first part is I define this counter interface, which is going to be the interface that the web application is using to talk to that stateful service. And all it does is just do get count async. And it's the stateful service that's actually going to implement that guy. So you see here, there's iCounter, and then here's the implementation of that getCount API. And the code here looks fairly similar to what we saw in run async method. There's a transaction, querying for that dictionary, getting the value, and returning it back. Then on the web side, I've just done some very basic integration here where I'm using this. So the service proxy is the thing that's going to generate that client proxy based on the interface that you're providing. And I do have to tell the service proxy what is the endpoint that I'm trying to talk to. So again, those two parts of communication, the first part, the service discovery, I'm taking this well-known stable URI that represents that stateful service and using it to resolve internally, as it turns out in this case, with the remoting API, into an IP address that I can talk to. This will be common kind of regardless of the way that you're ultimately doing the interaction between services. And then I'm just taking that value that I get back, putting it into the view property bag, and using it in the display. So let's try to deploy this guy. Let's see if it works. Oops.
slide yet.
There it is. Okay. So this should start to increment. There it goes. So yeah, doesn't look especially sophisticated, but now we've got two services. We've got this web application that's talking to that stateful service, using that remoting infrastructure, getting that value back, and being able to display it. Okay, cool. So now we've got two services. Let's add a third. And when we add a third, we're going to go a little bit, you know, off. These have been two .NET services. They're using this remoting infrastructure, which is you know, something that's useful for two .NET services. But obviously, now we live in a polyglot world. We want to have services that are written in other frameworks. So what I have is I have a basic Node application that's going to take this counter that's being returned by the stateful service and do a check just to determine if that number is prime. So, you know, not particularly sexy, but let's take a look at how that works. So I'm going to go under my app here and add another service. And we have this UI built in for bringing in a guest executable, so bringing in something that's not a first-class Service Fabric service. So I'll call this node service. I'm going to browse to where the code for that node app is on my machine, which is here. Bring that in. I can decide whether to just link to that location or actually copy it directly over. Then I have to choose what is the actual executable that I want to run. And in this case, it's a node application. It's interpreted. So what the exe that I'm running is the node exe, which I need to include then in my service package. And then the argument to that is the JavaScript file, which is prime checker, spell checker would be good. And then I choose the working directory for that service. So let's go ahead and add that. Oh, that's not good. Oh, it's probably already there. Let's give it a different name. Never practice your demos. You end up with things with the same name. That's the lesson here.
I will shave my head if the demo doesn't work.
I appreciate your support. Really putting your neck out there, Manny.
You're very welcome, Sean.
Yeah. All right. So, node.
Do I expect you to reciprocate during my part of the demo?
Hey, now. I'll grow my hair. Let's see if this works. Okay, cool. So now I've got that service. And again, same deal. If I deployed this, I would have that node service deployed, but it's not actually, you know, it's not connected to anything. So there's a couple things I need to do. The first one is I actually need to tell Service Fabric that node application wants to have a communication endpoint. So this is inside of the Service Fabric, the service manifest for that node application, which is being created by Visual Studio. I need to tell it that it's going to need an endpoint, which is going to do the registration of that name. And I need a port. It's listening on port 3000. Okay. So now we've got an endpoint. Now how do we get the web application to actually talk to this node service? So I'm going to go back over here into my controller, into the index, and add a bunch of code. So again, here I'm not using remoting. I'm actually going to just use this service partition resolver, which is a client API for talking to the naming service. But again, I need to provide that stable name for, in this case, the node service so that I can get back an IP address that I can talk to. So this is called my app. And the service is node service 2 now. And I need to do a little bit of just a second. Let me just resolve these namespaces, and then I will do just that. Now, the other thing I need to do is this is calling the service partition resolver is going to give me back a list of endpoints. this is an entry-level developer talk. This is demo code. So the point of this is that there is a way to just talk to the naming service for a guest executable, get an IP address that I can then talk to. For a real application, you would have a whole bunch more error handling here to deal with cases like the service has actually moved to a different node and being able to disambiguate between that type of error versus errors in the application itself. So there's a whole bunch more here. So when I zoom in, don't take a picture and copy this into your code. The point is simply that this is possible for these guest executables. Did I get everything? Okay. I guess we want to get rid of that guy. Okay, so there's that the service partition resolver. I'm looking up it based on that stable URI name. I'm getting back a series of endpoints. I'm just picking one with the get endpoint, and then I'm passing in my query string, which is checking primality, passing in the count number, and then parsing the JSON response that comes back. And the last thing I need to do is actually just update the view. Oops. So I'll change this guy. Okay, so now if we go to debug, hopefully this will give us something slightly more interesting. Oops. So I should say, when you hit debug in Visual Studio, that's doing a number of things. It's first building the set of services that you've included. Then it's creating an application package and deploying it out to the cluster. And the way that it deploys it out to the cluster is actually via a set of PowerShell commandlets that are included. There's this PowerShell script that's included in the project. And so you can see the way that Visual Studio is actually doing the deployment. And this was kind of one of our core principles around how we built the developer experience, is not to have Visual Studio do any magic. So you can go and look at exactly what it's doing and then turn that into something that you can script yourself, as opposed to having being left to figure it out for yourself. So let's see if this is gonna give us an answer. Oh no. What have I done? Let me quickly. There, that guy's there. Okay. Well, what you should have seen is the value of the counter, and then whether or not it's prime. Now, what I will try to show you very quickly before I wrap up is taking the same application. Deploying it out to a remote cluster. So everything that that I've been doing here has been on a local cluster. You can take those same application packages and deploy them out to a remote cluster. So here's a finished version of the application. If I go into publish, Visual Studio will actually do a lookup based on, so if you have clusters that are deployed in Azure, we'll do a lookup based on your Microsoft account and the associated subscriptions to see what clusters you have available to deploy to. You can set up clusters based on Azure Active Directory or cert-based authentication, and Visual Studio will do the necessary things to be able to connect and do that deployment. Now, I've actually got a version of the application already deployed, so hopefully we can see the working one. which is probably up to quite a large number by now. There it goes. Okay, so there. You've now seen the end state of the demo. So taking that number, returning back whether it's prime. Now, imagine that I had a bug, which you know would never happen except for 30 seconds ago, that I wanted to go debug running in Azure. We actually offer remote debugging of applications that are running inside of Azure. So here I've got Cloud Explorer, which is the new Visual Studio tool for looking at all of my cloud resources. And I can go to this cluster, right-click on it, and attach debugger. Maybe. There it goes. And that's going to go look up the set of processes that are available. I'm going to find my stateful service. Somewhere here. There it is. And it's going to try to attach. I've got this breakpoint set. And so hopefully, once that attaches, and I go back here and refresh, we'll actually get the breakpoint hit. We are debugging a distributed system running in the cloud. Keep that in mind. Oh, and we lost our remote connection.
Prime numbers are hard.
They really mess with RDP.
Crypto.
Yes. Is it attaching? Let me try refreshing one more time. Something's happening. Yes. So we've connected to that process running in a data center, running in Azure directly from Visual Studio. And I can now step through this code as if I was running it locally, which is pretty cool. Not recommended for production deployments. Actually, both the publish step I showed you and the debugging step, very much dev test scenarios. Please don't do that in production and then call support. We will not be happy with you. So with that, that's kind of the Windows developer experience for Service Fabric. But since we have some time left, we've heard rumors that there is distributed systems work happening on Linux. Have you heard? It's crazy.
It's true.
But this is what we're hearing from our sources.
Yeah.
And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Manny to talk a little bit about Service Fabric on Linux.
Yeah, apparently there's another operating system
yeah.
that we need to support. Hey, my clicker works. All right, so as Sean said, there is another distributed systems platform that we, or rather, another operating system that we want to run our distributed systems platform on. So I'll show you a few demos. But prior to that, I just wanted to take a step back and, you know, one of our ambitions as a platform is, hey, you know, we want you to be able to run anywhere. Like, as Sean mentioned earlier, we can run on Azure, we can run on hosted clouds, we can run on-premise. You can do all that. He also said, like, you can run guest executables and guest containers, so pretty much any framework, any code you want. You can use native Service Fabric applications, which use our programming model. You can do all that. But there's one thing missing. You know, I might have some code that is only going to be running in one operating system. What do we do about that? So because our ambition is to run anything anywhere, so we definitely wanted to run on Linux as well, so people have all the choice that they need to run their code anywhere using Service Fabric. And you know, today's world, about nearly one in three VMs that are running on Azure today are Linux. So a lot of customers are using Linux VMs and are using a mix of both Windows and Linux for various tasks. There are tasks where Windows systems are better. There are tasks where Linux machines are better. So that's kind of the prelude to this. Now, you know, we had a couple of guiding principles when we started this exercise of, okay, let's support the platform on Linux. One, let's not change something that is unnecessary. Just let's not change it just because we can, even though we would love to. So most of the things, like the runtime behavior, derives from the same source code, behaves the same. Concepts remain the same. The application model that Sean talked about remains identical. The kind of things that we support, stateless, stateful, all of that is essentially the same. And we also provide the same portal experience with Service Fabric Explorer, again, something that Sean showed, like which tells you what's the status of your cluster, what's the status of your application, et cetera. All those things are the same. But on the other hand, we definitely do want to change what needs to be changed. So, you know, if you're on Linux, chances are you're not yet using PowerShell, and you're not yet using, or you're using not the full Visual Studio, but just Visual Studio Code. There's going to be a lot of Java developers. So we took all that we took all of that, and we decided, oh, you know what? We need to go to where the Linux developers are, which means support for Azure CLI so people can use Bash, support for Eclipse and Yeoman to scaffold apps and to build apps, and of course use Linux-specific mechanisms for provisioning, like you don't download an MSI from anywhere. You do an apt-get install on Debian distros, for example, and you don't have ETW event tracing for Windows on Linux. So you know you use some other tracing technology like LTTNG. Now, a lot, you know, it's very uncommon that people walk around with Linux laptops. I haven't seen as many. So a lot of developers do their development on a Mac, and they publish to a Linux server farm. So we wanted to make sure that we had a one-box experience on Linux so people can still do it on their desktop, but also have some support for a Mac. Then, in terms of languages, as I mentioned, like Java is fairly popular, and we want to make sure Java is as good a first-class citizen supported natively in the platform programming models as much as C#. And finally, you know, containers are the big thing right now, or people are talking about containers all the time. So, you know, we really cannot have a distributed systems platform, you know, or a microservices platform that doesn't orchestrate containers. So we do orchestrate Docker containers as well. Now, with that, I'm going to jump into the demo portion of this. Let's talk more demoing. Okay. So this is a Linux machine, and since it's going to be hard for y'all to see what is on the screen, so I'm just going to show this is a Linux machine. I'll come back to this in a second, but I'm just going to SSH into it from my Mac so you can see what I'm doing much better. So this is the same machine that I'm SSHing to. You know, since people don't have faith anymore, I'm just going to do SSH again, that I'm not trying to pull a fast one. So I already have a Service Fabric cluster that is running here, but let's actually go back and say, how do you provision? How do you actually get the bits? So you can do things like sudo apt-get install, Service Fabric, and it'll pull the runtime. So, and you can install the Service Fabric SDK for Java, you can install the Service Fabric SDK for C#, you can do all that, and it'll pull the necessary bits or put into an apt repo so you can get it from there. And then, of course, you start the cluster using a simple cluster setup script. The cluster is already running, so you know you can look at the number of processes that are running on this machine by doing a grep. On the other hand, you can also see this in Service Fabric Explorer. You can see that, hey, you know, I have a cluster that's up on the same machine. You know, five-node cluster up running. That's what I have. So now let's actually go ahead and build a sample app for this and deploy it to that cluster. So the tool that I'm going to show you, the command line tool that I'm going to show you is called Yeoman. So I'm going to say yo. Pretty cool.
Not to be confused with the app.
Yes. So I'm going to just start by writing a simple Java application. So I just chose, hey, I want to write an Azure SF Java app, and I'm going to name my app my Java app. And I'm making it a stateful actor service. I'm going to call it my service. And it's basically built the scaffolding. Just like what you saw in Visual Studio, when you click File New, it's essentially created the same kind of scaffolding for a Java app. So You can go in here, and you can see all the files here. I'm not going to show you the code because it's just the same code that Sean showed for the counter in Java. Nothing different. It's the same thing. It does the same thing. It gets a count, increments it. That's pretty much all what it does. So I'm going to go ahead and build. So this will take a few seconds. And once it builds, I'm going to go ahead and use the Azure CLI to deploy it to my local cluster. So, which is what you would do with, you know, with PowerShell scripts that are being used on Windows. So Azure CLI is just like, you know, is essentially Bash. So it works like Bash. It will have autocomplete. It's based on Node. So it is like I can do things like, hey, Azure Service Fabric. I have to first source my autocompletion script. See, unlike Sean, I didn't practice my demo.
Came back to haunt me, though. So maybe you're better off.
So in this particular case, you know, I can do, let me type. Come on. Service Fabric. And it's going to auto-complete, and it's going to tell me what are things that you can do. So if you just do Azure Service Fabric, it's going to give you a dump of all the commands that you can type. And I'm SSHing it. So if you see the delay, it's just because it's actually going through the network. So you can see, you know, all the commands, and you can always go into one level detail and see what those commands are, et cetera. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and install this application, deploy this application to the local cluster. You see three commands there, you know, application package copy, application type register, and create application. So I'm just going to run that script, which will do the same. And in a few seconds, you will actually see here that application is going to start showing up, and the service is going to start showing up as well, as it initially copies the application, registers it, and then starts the application. Well, that seems to be running really slow. Which is kind of very surprising. But as it does that, let's go ahead and let it do that. So that's one part of it where you're using a command line interface to copy and not just copy, to create the application. You saw that, you know, using Yeoman, you created the Java application. Then you can use the editor of your choice, like Vi or Emacs or VS Code, whatever, to edit the Java app, and that's what you can do. But of course, you know, a lot of Java developers do use Eclipse, so we do have an Eclipse plugin. So, you know, I'm just going to show you what it looks like. So, you know, I have a plugin that I've already installed on Eclipse here. So if I did a file new, other project, you know, I see Service Fabric is one of the options here because I've installed the plugin and it'll tell me, hey, you can create the actor project or the stateless service or a couple of other options. And when I click OK, it's going to create the same scaffolding, and then I can use, you know, it's essentially everything that you do in Eclipse to run the project, deploy it to the local cluster, and start the cluster. And hopefully, this is done. Yeah, so it has already deployed. And now I'll go back. Here you should see, I have a window open already. So let's go back to that. Ah, come on. My mouse skills are being tested. Yeah, OK. I hope I did use the same machine that I was deploying this to.
Yeah, pro tip if you're ever doing demos of Service Fabric, set that slider all the way to the right. You'll get the fastest refresh. Again, maybe not something you want to do in production because it does pound the naming service, but for demos, it's great.
I'm wondering why it's not refreshing. Okay, give it a second to refresh. I think there's something going on with the network here. Oh, you know what I didn't do? Because, you know, the environment that we run in is actually the same environment that you actually deploy to cloud. I didn't really connect to the local cluster. That's probably the reason. It's deployed to some other cloud cluster. So it is running somewhere.
We've lost our application. If anybody sees Manny's application, please call.
That's probably what happened. Now I can probably verify that.
It's going to be so scared.
There you go, my Java app type. This was my second part of the demo where I would tell you, hey, look how easy it is to deploy this to the cloud. It's so easy sometimes. So, okay, the second part of the demo is done. Let me now go back to the first part of the demo, do some time traveling. Now I've connected to, let me just make sure that I'm connecting to a local cluster here. I was wondering, I didn't get any errors, it's deployed, where is it? Why is it not showing? So now I've connected to my local cluster. And now if I actually go to my application and I do install.sh, in a few seconds, these artifacts will start showing up there, and you'll actually see the application, and I can show you a demo of the application.
You did that intentionally, didn't you, just to make that point?
I wish. I didn't practice. I didn't commit that mistake. Now, as it does this, you know, it's still copying the app. Well, it's almost done, so it should come back in a few seconds. You can see that it's still registering, so it's going to take a few more seconds for it to actually happen. Now, after this, what I was planning to show you is how easy it is to deploy. I'll just show you the command that you do. Instead of using localhost that I just did, you know, Azure Service Fabric connect, cluster connect localhost colon 19080, I just instead use the fully qualified domain name of the Azure cluster. So in this particular case, it would have been ignite linux something.cloudapp.azure.com. And at that point, every command that I run is identical to what I run on my local machine. And that's why it was, you know, initially I didn't know where did this application disappear. Because the same copies, the same register, and the same start command is what you run. So now it's copied.
So maybe it's worth just pausing here for a second, because we kind of glossed over this detail. But remember, I was talking about application types and then instances. When you see register in the command line output and then create, the register is the verb that's associated with the type. So I've built this application type that's got a version. And you can think of that just like you would have a C# type. And then you're printing out instances of that application type. And so you can have multiple instances of a given type, which makes it really easy to do things like multi-tenant SaaS scenarios where you can just pound out different application instances based on the same original type.
So now you saw that the application is deployed, and in a few seconds, you know, it'll just continue and it'll just come back. So let's leave it like that for now. So that's essentially the demo that I wanted to show you. Now, I would, if you have time, we also support C#, a .NET Core application. So you can actually do a Yeoman start and again build a .NET Core application, and you can basically do the same thing as you did with the Java application. You can register it and you can run. So now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to try to test this application. So we have a test, a test client that is built in. When you create the application, it builds you a test client as well to make it easy. I don't have any fancy UI to show you, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to put this in a watch window so you can actually see it refreshing. Watch minus N, one, test client.sh.
Are you jealous of my web UI skills, Manny?
Web UI skills, indeed. I saw that, yeah. So now it's just a counter, you know, it's just going to keep incrementing the counter every few seconds, and it's going to increase. So counter went from 0 to 1. No surprise there what number is going to come next, and just keep going.
If you need to count integers, we have the platform for you.
The right platform for you. Now, what I'm going to go ahead and do is I'm going to take down a node. So this one is, I'll find out which node is actually running in this particular application. I'm doing remote desktoping, so here it's just taking a long time after I click to respond. So you'll find that there are 3 replicas of stateful services here. So what that means is the primary is kind of the source of truth where you can read and write. It can do both read and write. The others are just standing by. You can read from them, but you cannot write. So the idea here is, if for some reason the primary or the node goes down, you know, node 0 here goes down, then you have 2 other replicas that are standing by to take exactly up from where the primary left off without losing any state. So in this case, it's running on node 0. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is I'm going to restart node 0.
Again, not recommended for production.
Not recommended for production. I think we have a pop-up that actually shows you that as well.
You can imagine why we added that pop-up.
It's going to tell you, it's going to want to ask you, you know, you'll find out that it'll tell you, are you sure? Do you really want to do this? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do a restart. It's asking me, are you sure?
Do it.
And trying to.
I'm feeling lucky.
Node underscore 0. So in a few seconds, what will happen is, once that goes through, is that you'll get some exception messages thrown here because it's basically trying to tell you that, hey, something bad happened and the node went down. But then the count will just resume from where it was. It'll take place in a few seconds. And the other thing that you'll find is the primary will actually switch from node 0 to some other node. That is, if I did enter it right. And the RDP is just making it a little harder. Meanwhile, while it does that, node 0, let's keep in mind node 0. Yeah, so now you actually saw that it swapped. The primary switched to node 2, and what you would find is even though the primary went down, the count continues. It'll just continue in a few seconds. It's just taking time to refresh, but the count will just continue from 21. You won't lose that count. It'll keep incrementing. So that's a failover example, and I'm just going to Control-C and start again and see if that helps. Show the count. Lesson to self, network demos are not great. Yeah, see, 21 to 22, we got it. It took some time, but we got it. All right. Now, that's one part of this. Now, what I'm also going to show you is, well, today, you know, containers are very much the rage, so I'm going to kind of show you a quick container demo and as well as a little bit of a one-box experience. First, let me actually show you the one-box experience on the Mac. So, you know, as I showed you, we have Eclipse on Linux, and, you know, you can use Eclipse to build your Java applications and your other Service Fabric applications. In addition to that, we want to make sure that you had a reasonable one-box experience as well on the Mac. So what we did is we used a Vagrant VM under the hood to enable things like building on Mac using Eclipse without necessarily, you know, feeling that, hey, you're working across multiple things. It's fairly seamless, so if you know, you could go to the shell, you just do Vagrant SSH, and now, you know, I can get Azure SLI, I can do Yeoman start something, it will all just work. But if you also, for example, if in this case I've already installed Eclipse, and I could actually, you know, now just do exactly what I would do on Linux, I could actually say file, new, other, and it'll give me the same options here. So I'm just going to pick one, and I'm going to say, yeah, let's actually do this. Project name is test, my test, and finish. And it's creating the same scaffolding that Yeoman creates for you, but it creates it in a folder so it can basically talk to the Vagrant VM underneath without making it seamless for you. I'm just going to show you an example that run configuration. I'm going to go ahead and just try to deploy this. I'm going to say test 2. I'm sorry, my test is my workspace, so I'm going to say my test, my run. So this will do everything. This will build the application, call Vagrant under the hood, copy the application, register the application, and start the application. And to make it easy, we also have a private network that we set up between the Mac and the Vagrant box, so you can actually see, hey, from the Mac itself, I can see what are the applications that are running, what is the status of those applications, and so on. And in a few seconds, what you'll see is the number of applications will increment as it connects to the box underneath, copies it, registers it. You'll see two applications coming up. So again, the idea is to make the experience as seamless as possible. Now you see that the second application showed up. You know, so using the Mac, I just said run and deploy, and it deployed, and this is deploying to the Linux VM underneath. It just does that in a seamless fashion. Now the other thing I wanted to show before we wind down is that containers are the rage. I'm sure you know all of you are looking for containers. So this one I'm just going to show in the same Linux box as earlier. So you know I could do yo, and it's going to start up a container. It'll give me the options, and it'll say, hey, one of them is Azure SF Guest. I'm going to say, yes, Azure SF Guest, and I want a container application right now. So yes, it's a container. I'm going to call it Node.js app, node on SF. Let's call this node on SF. And now it asks you for the image name. This can be pointing to a Docker hub. So here I'm going to say Rajit N, node on SF. This is already an image that we have there, so I'm just going to use that.
Rajit is a developer on the Service Fabric, just a random guy whose image we're grabbing.
So now it's creating a template and everything so that all what you needed was the link to the Docker Hub. And now you could do cd node.js app, and it's all, you know, you also get these helper scripts. Now there's one thing I need to do here is update the version here. And now I can run install.sh, and it's going to, again, take this container image, which is actually running a Node.js application, and it'll copy it over, register it, and start it. And you can find whether it's working by going to the page here. It's running on localhost 8085, so once it's registered, you will actually see we can actually hit the endpoint. Now, in addition to this, it's almost done right now, but the other thing is, you know, there are not too many one-container demos. You have multi-containers. Multiple containers is what you use for real applications. So we have one that is running here already, and you have a two-container demo that I've set up here in the Ignite Linux, which is the one that I accidentally deployed an app to called Simple Container App. Yes. And it has a stateless backend and a frontend. And all what the frontend and the backend are doing are, the frontend is doing is, hey, I'm running on this particular node in the Azure cluster. What are you running? You're running on a particular node. So that's all what it's displaying. So now what I'm going to go ahead and do here is I'm going to take restart node 0 because that's where it says it's connected to the backend. So in a few seconds, what you're going to find is, I'll have to enter my nodes underscore 0, restart. So while it restarts, you'll find that, hey, you know, the backend service currently running on my node 0 will actually now move to some other node because, you know, that's no longer active once the restart completes. It moved to node 1. Yay! So the failover happened. The frontend could now see that the naming service helps the frontend discover that, hey, the backend which was running on node 0 has moved to node 1 because node 0 went down, something bad happened to it, and seamlessly it just transitioned to node 1. Now let's go back to the node application, which I deployed, it must have completed, and this is now just running on my local host, so I'm just going to hit the endpoint. It's going to tell me, hey, I'm running Node.js in a Docker container on Service Fabric, and of course, so that's pretty much showing you that, hey, we can run Java applications, .NET Core applications, anything in containers, all are fair game. And for added coolness, I can also show you that, you know, there is this game that was written on Service Fabric on Windows called Age of Ascent. So this is running on .NET Core, so we essentially made sure that this can run on Linux as well. It was a very good test case for us to make sure, you know, we are doing all the right things. It has a, I don't know how to play, so I need to learn to stop, okay. It has about 7 applications, a total of about 35 microservices is part of this application. And I can SSH to one of these machines and show you it's a Linux machine. So, you know, for example, if I go to, you know, let's do this. That's the same endpoint, Illyriad Games, that's exactly the same endpoint I showed you. I'm going to connect to one of those machines in the cluster. And now if I do a grep for the fabric processes, you'll find that, hey, .NET Fabric, this is all real stuff. It is not made up stuff. That, you know, we're getting to now conclude our talk with a recap. So I'm going to switch. So you can run .NET Core, Java, or containers. Recap, microservices give you agility and a lot of flexibility and is the right pattern for a lot of applications. It allows you to efficiently use resources. Service Fabric makes it easy for you to develop microservice-based applications on both Linux and Windows. And finally, you know, as Sean mentioned, I don't know if he mentioned or not, but like I don't know if you followed the news. So we are in public preview on Linux right now with Java and Linux, as well as .NET Core on Linux as well. So it's available for you to actually download from the app repo. Now, closing thoughts. I'll let Sean provide the closing thoughts here.
Yeah, so we'll open it up for questions, but we thought since Service Fabric's all about efficiency that we would kind of run through some of the common questions that people ask so that we can get to the second order ones. So obviously, Manny talked about Java and .NET Core on Linux, and so the natural question is, well, can't we do that on Windows too? So yes, that'll be coming in preview fairly soon. Again, same kind of thing. Hey, you're showing containers on Linux. We heard that Windows containers is kind of going to be a thing. What's the deal with that? Also coming very soon, as Windows Server is now rolling out, we'll make an SDK available that allows you to deploy Windows containers on Server 2016. Windows Server Nano also coming soon. You see kind of a trend here. The next one's kind of interesting. In my demo I showed in Visual Studio, you know, adding one service after another, I got up to three services. As Manny mentioned, Iliad Games is up to 30-something services. Eventually, that does become a bit of a challenge from a Visual Studio perspective. It's really easy to get started, but then, you know, once you've got a huge number of services, managing that does become a little bit tricky. So we're looking at options for how we can make that easier to split those services out across different Visual Studio solutions, but still ultimately coalesce them back up into a single Service Fabric application that gets deployed. So look for developments on that front. We talked about Java and .NET in terms of first-class support for reliable services and reliable actors. So people often ask about, hey, when do I get Ruby and Go and JavaScript and what have you. One thing that we're planning to do is to open source the programming model, so the Java and .NET APIs, and then the native interop layer that they talk to. And part of the goal of that is to show people how they could build additional programming language on top of that core. But we'll also be adding more first-class support over time. So if you have strong opinions about which languages you'd like to see first, we'd love to hear them. Cloud services, a lot of people ask about, you know, is Service Fabric a good option for migrating from cloud services? And the answer is generally yes. And we've got great documentation. Just go use your favorite search engine, Service Fabric Cloud Services. We've got some articles that walk you through how to do that. There are a couple of caveats. One is around Service Fabric and IIS don't play particularly well together, so you need to move anything that you've got in a web role today that's dependent on IIS into a self-hosted model, potentially built on top of ASP.NET Core. And then the other one is just if you are running today a like 2VM deployment, so the min to get the SLA for cloud services, that's lower than the minimum deployment for Service Fabric, which for production is 5VMs. So if you're in that range, then that, you know, might not be an option. VM scale sets might be better for you. And then the last one is today our preview for Linux is based on Ubuntu, and so people ask about other distros. I think Red Hat is the most kind of near-term addition to that.
It's being worked on.
Yeah. But again, if you've got strong opinions about which ones you'd like to see next, definitely let us know. And with that, just a bunch of resources. We think we have pretty good documentation. We've definitely spent a lot of time on it. We've got some samples, both for .NET and for Java now. There is a, if you're the type of person that likes to go really in-depth and go through kind of a full set of course material, there is a course that was actually prepared by Jeffrey Richter, who's many people may know, and is now actually an engineer on the Service Fabric team. So he's prepared a course that you can run through. We'll call out the party clusters, which is a way to run in Azure for free. So you get a cluster that you get access to potentially with some of your closest friends or complete strangers, but you can deploy from Visual Studio the same experience that I showed, run inside the cloud for a couple of hours for free. And then if you want to create a production cluster, that's available through the portal, both for Windows and for Linux. So with that, I'll point you again to the other sessions this week, and then we'll take questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And if you can, yeah, if you can come up to the mic to ask questions, that'd be great.
Ready to turn it on or?
Hello.
There we go.
Yeah. How does it handle HA across compute fault domains and different storage accounts and whatnot?
Sorry, how does it handle HA across?
Like compute fault domains or like different storage accounts, right? Because we've been told to sort of divvy things up across these things for avoiding single point of failure. So how does this map to that? Because you mentioned scale sets a minute ago, so it sounds like they may not be using the same mechanisms.
No, we are using scale set under the hood. So
you are, okay.
Yeah. So you get the fault domains and everything else that you do.
So when I said you might be better off with scale sets for cloud services, I meant like directly using scale sets, but scale sets sits underneath service fabric layering.
And storage accounts, how does it work across those? Do I need, so what I was told today was to get two storage accounts to like be on different storage stamps, I guess they're called. To avoid that single point of failure? How does that map?
Yeah, so that's just a restriction today where, you know, I think the VMs are all sharing the storage account. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's a point in time thing. So that's why we are recommending, hey, add another storage account so you get a little more, you avoid the single point of failure. But it's a feature in the works, so we'll have five storage accounts.
One thing that we didn't talk about, and this is something probably should go to the talk on Friday from Jaco and Rishi around kind of setting up the infrastructure, is service fabric clusters can be made up of multiple node types. And so those node types are each mapped to a VM scale set. And then you can use what we call placement constraints to actually tell the service fabric resource balancer to place your services according to those node types, which is something you might want to do for having, if you want to have sort of front end nodes that have like your web services and then back end nodes that have sort of your more traditional middle tier kind of services. But those each map to independent scale sets. So that's kind of another piece of the puzzle. But definitely go to the talk on Friday if you're interested in that aspect.
Very cool. You guys are headed the right direction. Glad to see this.
Great. Thank you.
My question is around service communication. Instead of using remoting, if we're using event-based messaging over a service bus, is there any gotchas with setting service fabric up on top of a service bus?
Not sure exactly what that would entail. So are you actually doing this today? Or
no, it's something that we're planning on doing, is putting a service bus in place to allow the services to communicate, by basically just putting an event on the bus, pulling an event off the bus. And I didn't know, because from what I understand, the Azure service bus is built using the service fabric.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So I didn't know if there was going to be any gotchas or anything with doing something like that.
It's fine.
Okay, great.
Yeah, your question about you're not installing service buses in your bus. You're going to use service buses.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I don't think
it is. We were talking also about installing it locally using a standalone version of the service bus as well. So that's probably where the wording got confused.
So on the same bus, you will not be able to install service bus because service bus under the service fabric and it will set up your bus for its own use and it will not allow it to set up another bus along the same.
Okay.
So you would have to.
Sir, can you please use the mic?
My question about the stateful service. So you mentioned that we can use the primary for read-write and the replicas for read operations. So I was wondering, in the example you showed us in the demo, when I perform a read operation, let's say the client is calling the stateful service, is the naming service doing this kind of a load balancer or something, or reverse proxy to route the call to any one of the stateful service instances, or it always goes to the primary?
So for writes, it will always go to the primary. You have the option to turn on reads on the secondary, in which case you can route those reads to those secondary replicas, but you have to understand that state may be stale.
I thought, with the stateful service, the data is always replicated.
So the data is always replicated, but it's a quorum commit model. So as long as there's a majority of the replicas that act back, that they receive the state, then we will return back the commit API call, and it's committed and it's safe. But you may have more replicas than that, and so potentially if you do a read to one of those secondaries that was not one of the ones that act, it could be out of date.
Uh-huh. So for example, let's say if I have 8 replicas, so let's say like 3 of them are good, then...
8 replicas?
Typically an odd number is good.
Yeah.
Because you want to have, you know, n over 2 plus 1. Mm-hmm. So okay. you would probably have, say, 9 replicas, and then you would need to get 5.
Yeah.
5 of them to say that they got the state.
Oh, I see. The other question...
Primary, yeah.
Uh-huh. I see.
So it is possible, and if you want to know more about like the actual gotchas and whatnot, you can come to the booth and then I can explain to you in terms of how the application protocol works and why if there's a good idea or not a good idea.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. The other question is, we have a quick question about the example when you set up the ASP.NET Core web application. So you only had one node. So if this is like a stateless service, so if I have, let's say, 3 nodes in my cluster or 5 nodes of that service, so when I call the service, you know, what's the load balancing mechanism? What's the URL? How can I call the service? I don't want to call the node directly. I want to go through like a VIP or reverse proxy to do that.
So typically what will happen is if you're running in Azure, you'll have that stateless service deployed on every node, at least within the node type. Uh-huh. And then you've got the load balancer set up to spread load across those nodes. And so you'll go in through that VIP in the load balancer, and it'll display it out across.
And the load balancer is external to Service Fabric, correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome. Sir, go ahead.
Hi, a very general question. A lot of classic apps will be keeping data in SQL or tables or Redis or whatever. What's the value prop for them of moving to sort of replicated, stateful Service Fabric storage?
When your compute and data are co-located, you know, assuming that, you know, you do have state, then you get a couple of advantages. One, hey, you don't need to pay for a SQL Server license, or you don't need to pay for those VMs that are managing that. So you'd get rid of that. Second thing, your compute and data are on the same machine. So you don't have a network hop, so you don't need things like a Redis cache where you have to cache some of these things here, pay that money. So it's all local, so you're always writing local. So those are some of the advantages you get. Reduce complexity, better performance.
That's cool. So you might be able to avoid caching at all, for example. If
you can, you might be able to avoid it, yeah.
Yeah.
You avoid the network hop, yeah.
Okay. But it's like anything else, there's trade-offs, right? So, I mean, if your existing model is working great, then why mess with it? But if you are looking for, you know, throughput gains or to remove that external dependency as part of your hot data path, then stateful services are a pretty good option.
And so on that note, what are we? What's the downsides of having state and Service Fabric?
The main, well, in terms of the downside, the main downside is that, hey, you are now using our programming model. So, you know, it's not a guest application or a, you know, something, it's not a stateless thing. It's basically something you're using now, our first-class programming models, which are in Java and C#. That's the main downside. And, of course, you will have to rewrite some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah.
All that. So that's how you would say, all hot stuff which you need and your group transaction is using, that is the right target. And then anything which is long-term storage, PR, text store, it's cheaper.
Yeah.
So that's how you would view your balance. Otherwise, you're paying for the VM.
To add to what Chuck was saying, is you don't want to end up, you know, paying for the VMs as storage units. Your VMs are primarily compute units. What this allows you is, hey, you have storage associated with the VMs, which gives you some advantages. But they're not, you shouldn't be saying, oh, let me add 20 VMs because I need 20 terabytes of data, so that shouldn't be a model. It's a compute first, then your VMs actually provide the data.
Kind of dovetailing on that, though, also have the standalone installer for on-prem.
Yeah.
In that case, you're not really paying for the VMs, or at least internally.
You're using your own.
You're only using your own compute resources. Yeah.
If you can get free VMs from somewhere, go for it, man.
So along those lines, and I know this is obviously going to vary, but in terms of reliable state scale, and it's going to be purely I/O bound. Is that a fair statement? And is there an upper bound in terms of, you know, if I've got an iReliable dictionary that's got, you know, a million objects in it, in terms of the hit of enumeration or anything like that? I mean, what is the sane model of the stateful services in terms of what you're persisting in state? And the other thing, kind of I asked it earlier today as well, is that just as a feature request, is there's no inherent encryption, from what I understand, in terms of the persistence of the state. That would be nice to have.
Two things. Whenever you always in a production system have to consider disasters can happen. So if you end up storing, like for example, you got a G5, you pay a lot of money, you got a G5 which has like 3 or 4 terabytes of data storage locally. You should think about, okay, if I lose one VM, what happens? You're moving that little state across. So that means when you are thinking about your reliable collections and the size of your dictionaries, you think about what can I fit in the RAM? Then when you do support larger data sets, again, you should think about how much time will it take in terms of to copy it over and creating another one. So those are things which will go into it. Typically, customers do not hit these at this point because they're bringing in hot data. It's not terabytes, it's gigabytes at that point. And so when if you are trying to do a stress test or a reliability test, that's when you run into these tests. So that's what you should think.
One more thing to point out, which again, this is very much an entry-level developer talk. We glossed over a whole bunch of stuff, including the notion of partitioning, right? So all the stateful services are partitioned, which is the way that you get scale out, is that you've got those services broken down into little chunks, and those can be split out across machines. So you're not actually, like, the notion of how much state can I store in a collection, there's no real answer to that, because if it's sufficiently partitioned, you've got a number of machines, you're just adding more and more storage.
Was there an SDK update as well with the GA of the standalone?
No, so the SDK that's out there now can be used to build applications targeting the standalone. We will have an update probably next week.
And the standalone is supported for Server 2016?
Yeah.
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 Perfect. Thank you. And,
No. Well, sorry. Not 2016, 2012, okay. Sorry, yeah.
Okay, all right.
But it will be.
Yeah, eventually, yeah.
All right, thank you.
All right,
cool,
thank you.
Thanks, everyone.